Week 13, film study with Ken McCusick. We're going to talk about the Ravens' victory, 44-20. This is the time we talk about the offense, and the offense actually put up some points this week. So, Ken McCusick, how are you doing?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing okay. I'm long day of work, but it continues. And you know what? The Ravens are in a good shape and still have a hold of this this playoff run for themselves. So it's
yeah,
we're in a good place.
We've got a good article on the wild card out there on the website if you want to take a look. But it kind of examines what happens with a 9-7 tie versus all the teams. And there's really only one team that the Ravens have to be concerned about, and this week's game impacts that pretty significantly. So the Kansas City Chiefs are the biggest chance to beat the Ravens in a head-to-head tiebreaker. Not because of head-to-head, but because of common opponents. If the Ravens don't win that, which they can win by one of three games going their way, then the Chiefs will beat the Ravens on strength of victory. So that's the biggest risk. The Jets can also tie the Ravens and beat them in a conference tiebreaker. But other than that, take a look at the website. A lot more detail that could be better served by the people who would like to go down line by line through an article than people
right.
who are listening to a podcast in their car.
No, and the lines change every game. Every time there's the football game, these lines are changing. So we'll talk about it in more. We got to mention it every week. Because in more and more, the Ravens' chances increase if they keep playing this way. I mean, they've won three in a row. Hopefully, they can make it four.
Yeah, a win over the Steelers would be big for their playoff hopes. And this week, this Steelers week is a really poignant one in this rivalry with the incredibly ugly game from Monday night against the Bengals. Just a nasty. It's not even football anymore when they want to play like that.
No, and no, it's not. And I obviously made the joke on the last one that it's a Steelers-Bengals game, so I'm going to root for injuries. Clearly, no one roots for injuries, and the way that the refs just let that game get out of control, I think there was more than one point where I thought they were going to toss someone, and instead they just said, it's his first personal injury or whatever. And then I think I was more surprised when I saw the suspensions come out, and it's just one game for everyone, whether you're Gronk and or these guys on Monday night. Everyone just got one game?
Well, that's right. And the one that I think anybody has different opinions on this, if you talk to Steelers fans and it being in the moment and whatnot, they think that Juju's hit was less severe than Gronk's because Gronk's was after the play and was a truly nasty hit. Juju, there was a taunting component to it after the play that it's like, yeah, I injured you and I'm going to stand over you for
right.
a few seconds. Both are bad. You know, probably they both deserved a suspension of some sort, a short one probably, given the way the league seems to be run. You know, 1 to 2 games would have been reasonable in either case, and I think they both are there.
See, so, yeah. Yeah, and I tend to lean towards the Steeler fans where I see the same thing, that the Gronk hit had no purpose at all, where the Juju hit, he's making a football play, he's trying to get the stop, things happen, and the taunting is then when he went over the line, in my eyes.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Because his during the course of play activity was less bad than Gronk, because Gronk did it after the play,
right.
but his taunting is what kind of made it worse.
Right.
This week, we've heard some things. So Harbaugh started out today's practice with a prayer for Shazier, and that was a very good thing to hear. I've seen a lot of very positive traffic today on Twitter back and forth about how each team really respects the other
right.
in the rivalry, and that's the big difference between the Ravens and Steelers versus the Bengals and Steelers, which is just
Yeah, it's much more of a fun rivalry than a hatred. It's a we like the Steeler matchups. Not because we hate Pittsburgh. We like the Steeler matchups because we split every year. We see each other in the playoffs all the time. The teams are competitive. It's always a
yeah.
tight game. Those are fun games. Those are what you want out of football. And, yeah, you want your team to win, but that's what you like out of a rivalry.
That's right.
And I'll make it very clear, I do not root for injuries. It's a joke, and it's a joke of I don't want to root for the Steelers. I don't want to root for the Bengals. So I mentioned injuries, but I don't really root for injuries. It's just unfortunate how things timed with Monday night.
Well, yeah, understood, Josh, and it's just one of those things that happens. But it's good that you're making that clear to our listeners. I appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't root for injuries. Just root for my team to win. But let's move on to the Ravens. Because, yeah, that Steeler game, that affects the Ravens. But the Ravens upcoming this week, they have a chance to deal with that and really take charge of, on their own. So let's look at what the Ravens did right with this with the offense side to really score points and do something we haven't seen from this offense all year against the Lions.
No, yeah, we certainly haven't seen it much. And the offensive line had its, what I would say is its second best game of the year. The performance at Oakland was just a slight notch above, and frankly, it was the best game I'd ever scored.
Okay.
But in this game, they did some wonderful things in pass blocking that are really special. So the Lions, first of all, they know they don't have the greatest pass rush. They had Ansah, who was playing a little bit dinged up and probably was not at his best. And they did a lot of scheming for pressures. Now, you've heard some of these numbers when I've been talking about them from Pease's standpoint and how often he does this thing. So how often does Pease rush 6-plus? Well, it had been 11 times before the last game. It was 9 times that the Lions rushed 6 or more in this game alone and 36 dropbacks. So it gives you an idea of what they were trying to do in terms of really get pressure with numbers. They rushed 5 men, which a lot of people consider a blitz, another 12 times. That's 21 out of 36. They quote-unquote blitzed by the definition a lot of people use. They had 8 pass rushes that I would term as deceptive by my definition. Those all involved a 2-man blitz where they set 2 on the same play, which is one blitzer does not quite get you deceptive, but 2 blitzers does individually. And the Lions, in 36 dropbacks, had 25 individual blitzes. Now, that's players rushing from inside the slot receiver and at least 1.5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. So 25 times they brought an individual blitz like that. Now, in the context of all of that, and obviously the Lions are coming from everywhere trying to get to Flacco,
right.
The Ravens still gave Flacco ATS 20 times in 36 dropbacks. That's 56%, an above-average total. They generated no sacks. Rushed 25 individual blitzes, no sacks. It's a complete failure.
Yeah.
And three quarterback hits in the game.
That's good. And I guess that then allowed Joe to at least find guys because they were more successful in the passing game.
Yeah, they did. They had so normally with that amount of ATS, I would look at it and say that each ATS opportunity is worth a certain number of yards based on Joe's past, and each not ATS opportunity is worth something. And when I do that simple math, I get to 229 net yards would have been my expectation on those 36 dropbacks given that mix of ample time and space and not ample time and space. He actually threw for 269. But when you think about it, granting ample time and space in this environment is worth more because more rushers are committed and the secondary than the second and third levels are more open in terms of the ability to separate, the ability to get yards after the catch, etc. So while I look at Flacco's number and say these best numbers of the season and he did outperform his opportunity set, I give the bulk of the credit to the offensive line in this one. They just played fantastic.
All right. And so you mentioned that this is your second highest scoring game of the season. We've had some low scoring games as well. What have we learned from this offense? Are they clicking? Are they getting hot at the right time, healthy at the right time? Or is this more of just it's the Lions?
It's really hard to say exactly what it is individually. Obviously, they solved the Lions blitz. And that was very key in this game, so that's why I'm giving most of the credit to the offensive line. When they solved it, the Lions had a really oh crap situation on their hands of having a very limited coverage set in the second and third levels. And the times Flacco has struggled most, the times that I remember, are versus Cincinnati, for example, or Denver, when they would just have a 4-man rush all the time against him. And when that 4-man rush is successful and they have 7 in the secondary, it's very effective always at keeping Flacco under wraps. And that you know, it wasn't possible this game because they didn't have seven in the secondary all the time.
Right. Now, one of the biggest plays for Flacco was when there was a point in the game where the Lions defenders looked completely confused.
Yes, to say the least. So, okay, let me set the scene here because the Ravens were leading 20-13 early in the fourth quarter. So it's 14-14 left in the fourth. I'll give you the time reference here because I really want you to go look at this one if you can on Game Pass or on your DVR, either one. But it's a crucial 3rd-and-7 play. And you remember the Lions had just scored a couple touchdowns. It was 20-0 at the half, and they made it 20-13 with a couple of touchdown drives. And it's looking like the Lions were making another comeback. And Ravens really needed at least a field goal, but they really needed a touchdown on the drive. So 3rd-and-7 came up. And all of a sudden, the Lions have 9 men on the field.
Now, isn't this the same? Am I thinking about the same play, or am I at a different point where the Lions almost got, on the play before, almost got a fumble, but it wasn't a fumble, and there was some confusion of the Lions trying to figure out whether or not they're going to challenge?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the same play, right? And the Ravens just did a hurry up.
Yeah, the Ravens got it, were prepared and got it done. The Lions did not throw a red challenge flag, and they didn't call timeout with 9 men on the field. No one was calling timeout that I could tell on the field.
A lot of the guys on the field looked like they were looking to the sideline trying to figure out with the timeout. Mm-hmm. Or not the timeout, but if we're going to challenge it.
Right. So anyway, on the play, as you see it develop from the top, 2 men covered Watson. Nobody covered Chris Moore. And Chris Moore all of a sudden is wide open in the middle of the field. And at the game, I didn't pick up on the 9 men. But I'm saying, how the heck did he get that open?
Right.
There's nobody within 8-9 yards of him. And he catches the ball. Big run after the catch to load up a 23-yard play there before they could get him down. And the Ravens scored 2 plays later. So that was probably the biggest single play of the game in terms of how it impacted things. And there is legitimate talk that Caldwell and perhaps others will lose their job over it. It's probably the defensive coordinator who should lose his job, although the head coach with his overall coordination failing on this is pretty bad, failing to get a timeout in particular.
All right. And that was a huge play. And Chris Moore is becoming more and more of a guy that fans are wanting to see more in because it seems like he's a guy who can catch the ball, and he seems to be making some big plays the little bit of opportunities he gets.
Right. He's had a few problems catching the ball this year. He had an interception go right through his hands in one of the games. I forget, Perriman also had one that game.
I was going to say, every wide receiver's had trouble with that.
Yeah, that doesn't really narrow it down. But anyway, Moore did have a good game this game, had a couple of nice sideline outs as well as that play over the middle, which I like. So, yes, by all means, he's going to get some opportunities the rest of the way as far as the Ravens go this year. This is a team, by the way, in 2008, the Ravens went to Pittsburgh for the AFC Championship game. And, you know, in the National Football League now, whoever your third wide receiver is pretty damn important because he gets a lot of snaps. In fact, your fourth wide receiver is pretty important because they get a lot of snaps. The Ravens went into the AFC Championship game in 2008 with Marcus Smith as their third receiver. Now, what made Marcus Smith special in that role as a third receiver? He had zero career catches.
Okay.
Not before or after. Now, that wasn't his rookie year or anything. It was before or after. He never had any catches. Good special teams player for the Ravens. But in that game, he still made a contribution. Flacco threw a ball to him in the end zone. He drew a pass interference call. The Ravens scored immediately thereafter to come within 16-14. And Marcus Smith made the biggest not catch of any of the players in Ravens history who've had very few total catches.
Right. So you're saying there's still a chance for Perriman.
That could be his comeback opportunity.
Right. All right, you mentioned this is your highest scoring, one of your highest scoring games. So let's get to the line, and you give the grades. Let's see did they get straight A's. We'll find out.
And let's, pretty close.
All right, let's start with Ronnie Stanley.
Okay, so Ronnie Stanley really getting hot at the right time right now. He's had 2 consecutive top shelf games, and he's hobbling, but he's gotten an A in both of them. This game he had a pressure and a half, and that was all his negative events. He missed 3 blocks in addition, but he just looked very good. he was aware in terms of changing. He was able to change out of stunts, which is something an injured player often is not able to do, is make a stunt handoff well, not give ground oftentimes before a stunt in order so he can't do it properly. But Stanley did a good job with all of that. And he's getting hot at the same time he did last year when he had those eight straight games at the end after the Pittsburgh game that were just terrific and really gave the Ravens a chance to get in the playoffs and gave us all the hope we have about Stanley this year. But great game for Stanley and coming at the right time.
All right. That's good. You're concerning me about that hobble, though. Hopefully that doesn't get any worse. How about James Hurst?
Okay, so James Hurst is having a fine year, and now some interesting questions really have to come up about him. So let's talk about his performance in this game, and then we'll get back to that. So the last eight games that he's played at guard, now remember he was sent to detention is the wrong word. He was sent to emergency service at left tackle for the Green Bay game, but otherwise in his games at guard, his last eight, he's gotten B, A, C+, A, C+, B, B, A. And during that time at guard, he's had 43 of 51 pulls. He made 9 of 10 in this game. And he had, let's see, what do you have in terms of negative things? He had one penetration allowed on a run play in this game. That was his only negative event here. He did have 3 missed blocks. But another fine game for Hurst and .90 per play unadjusted. With adjustment, it's an A. And he has... really elevated his own status. So next year is going to be a question of which team wants Hurst to start for them at left guard. It might be the Ravens. They may say, and I think that there's one particular path I can see pretty clearly, that Lewis is the guy at right tackle, that they want to keep Hurst at left guard.
Okay.
And it would increase the chances if for some reason they were not able to re-sign Jensen at center. Because I think the Ravens are going to have to find a way to economize somewhere. And Hurst will have a not insignificant contract. I mean, he could easily now, based on what I've seen and his history, I don't think he has any tackle swingman value. But I think you could say 4 years, $16 million. You know, I'm not the best at it.
Right, so he's going to be making more than if they just left Lewis in that position.
Yeah, and that's the key point, is that Hurst really projects to be a better player in 2018 than Alex Lewis. Alex Lewis will be coming back from an injury. It will be his third year, but you know, I can't project that he's going to be where Hurst is as a player. But you do get a cheaper player for 2 years if you stick with Lewis, and you also get the possibility of solving your issue at tackle of having not a reserve tackle if you put Lewis at right tackle.
Okay. All right. You mentioned Jensen. Jensen seemed to be back to the Jensen that we've fallen in love with the past few, after a down few weeks.
Yeah. It's not like he's been terrible or anything. He just hasn't been quite as good as he was at times earlier in the season. But he had one difficult reach block that he missed. Now, reach block is when you have to take a step to make a block. And it happened in Q4, and he got in the way of Skura's pull on that play. Now, obviously, that was not a well-scored play for Jensen, but what it really demonstrated to me is how little we've seen that happen this year. So when you see a player like Jensen, you know, make a fail on a difficult block is the way I'd put it. You realize how few times that the Ravens' pulling game has been messed up because Jensen has given ground or not been able to make the play he's supposed to. And he's usually the pivot point on all pulls. You usually cross Jensen in order to pull. There are exceptions. Sometimes a tackle goes outside a tight end on a pull, but most often you pass the center on a pull. So he played well. It gave him half a penetration, half a pressure, and he also gets an A after adjustment. Very good game from Jensen.
Any concern with his health?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm concerned about his elbow. He's wearing a brace now.
Right?
Yeah. So it's not a good thing when your entire line is in braces, and you don't always know exactly what it's for. In Jensen's case, he had some very apparent pain in his elbow at the very end of the previous game. So I'm glad he was able to play, and I'm that glad he was certainly glad he was able to play very well. But yeah, I'm naturally concerned about what this means going forward.
All right, you mentioned that Skura had his best game of the year, so he's a guy who we've really been looking to grow. So explain to me what was so good about Sunday.
Sure. Well, he's been very consistent the entire year in terms of making his blocks and not missing blocks. And he did have a half a penetration he allowed in this game, which is too bad. I didn't give him the whole thing, but he made a block to assist the player to his right, which would have been Howard. And then there was a blitzer who came on a run blitz, actually, and he didn't get that picked up. So I gave him half that penetration. I gave the other half to Jensen, being on the other side, who was also assisting. So he could have gotten more of that. I know PFF didn't score him well on that play. I didn't either, but anyway, it was what it was. He had a third of a quarterback hit in the game, and he had another block where he didn't look that great, but the pressure had already developed behind him, and I actually gave him a block on that one because I thought he held it for long enough. That's a lot more detail than I would normally give you, but anyway, Skurrett did score pretty well. Didn't have any solo negative events, which is one of the keys you look for. He only got 1 point on his three pulls because he had a negative one on the pull that didn't work out with Jensen obstructing him. But anyway, in total, A, and fine game. And again, I really like the consistency, and I think there's some undervaluation of the consistency of Skura from what I've seen from other services, that they're not necessarily putting a value on the block he provides every time, where he doesn't necessarily push a guy where they would give a positive score for. Sometimes he may even give a little ground, but it's ground that doesn't matter that much. But the key thing is he's getting in front of the guy opposite him.
Okay. So you gave everyone A's so far, but Austin Howard is your only guy without an A on the line?
Yeah, didn't get an A. I thought he actually played quite well, but he did have a significant holding penalty. An illegal block penalty in the back. So he only had one pressure allowed in the game, so that's terrific. But there was an 11-yard pass to Williams, and that came midway through quarter two, and he had a block in the back on Whitehead, number 59, the linebacker, and it was right as Williams was passing him. So it was not the kind of thing you could say, why did he hold? It was away from the play, or why did he block that way? It was away from the play. It was a complete waste. It actually kind of probably helped the runner, the fact that he did it, and so there's no real arguing with the penalty. It's a reasonable and fair call. So that reduced his score significantly. And just looking at this for a second, if instead he'd gotten a block on that, he'd have had 7 more points. He'd had 53. He'd have been, you know, B plus range, maybe even A minus range if it hadn't been for that that penalty.
Okay.
So he gets a C after adjustment, and that's where we are with Austin this week.
All right, so all A's except for a C for Howard, which is perfectly fine, as you've said. All right, let's move on to our offensive MVPs. It seems like we don't get to do offensive MVPs that much, but the offense had a big game this week.
Yeah, they sure did. So we've got some guys to pick. Your number three guy, do you want to go first?
My number three is Marty Mornhuweg. I think, and we'll get to it in the mailbag because I know there's some questions about it, but it sure seemed like the offense in play calling was different this week and a little more exciting, a little more they mixed things up.
Right. I think that's fair. That's not bad at all. Number three for me is Alex Collins. Big runs, continues to have not a lot of easy level two opportunities given to him. The team doesn't have Marshall Yanda there. They do have Hurst, which gives some good pulls to open some holes. And they do have Howard, who's a good seal blocker on that right side. But they have not had as many easy level two opportunities for Collins. He tends to get contacted earlier and get a lot of his yards after contact. So he gets my number three.
I always feel bad for Collins because once they get within like 10 yards of the end zone, they don't use them that often. And I feel bad that he doesn't always get the touchdowns, but he has been exciting. My number two is Patrick Ricard, just for his first career touchdown, and it was fun to see a different play like that come out from the Ravens offense.
Yeah, I mean, not only was that great, but we noticed about four times, and Maureen and I are scoring the game for the offensive line, but we do put in a note for other good blocks from eligible receivers in particular that happen while that's happening. So Ricard played, I want to make sure I have this correct here, 18 snaps on offense. And he had four noted mentions for big blocks on run plays. So very big contribution for him in that regard. So that's a great pick. I love it. My number two guy, Joe Flacco. Whatever you want to say about Joe, in terms of did he really outperform his expectation in this game, or was it more the offensive line giving this? I give him credit for taking advantage of the Lions' defense on the 23-yard play when they only had 9 on, making sure that he got a nice, easy pitch and catch in the middle of the field. I give him credit for managing the football exceptionally well. So he didn't have any turnovers, which is something that is not exactly captured without looking at it separately in terms of the how well did he do versus sample time and space. So he's had a couple games now in a row where he's managed the football extremely well. And that doesn't necessarily mean managing the game only. It means managing the football well. And that's been very positive. So Joe's my number two guy.
And my number one is Mike Wallace. It's been nice to see a wide receiver that we can count on.
Yeah, you know, that's great. It was a very deep cross. The Ravens offense had to depend on that play that the pass rush wouldn't get there because that play takes a long time to develop. Right. So, you know, it's one of those plays that really great to see them take a shot and really make Flacco hold the ball a little bit longer or ask Flacco to hold the ball a little bit longer to make that play. My number one, the Ravens offensive line as a whole. Now, last week I didn't want to do a, you know, wuss out and give it to two players or give it to three players when both Stanley and Howard had excellent games. But this week I can't help but give it to all of them. They played so well as a unit in solving the blitz that I was very happy with this. I could have also given it to Greg Roman as a number one. I just thought I'd leave that one for you just in case.
Oh, see, I don't always remember those coaches' names, so I would have missed that one, but that's a good one. Let's get to the mailbag, and we're going to talk with kind of what I was getting to with my pick of Marty, where Vaughn Takes asks on Twitter, did you see any significant difference in the play calling last week, formations, personnel, etc.? The ball was certainly up in the air more.
Right. They did a lot of chipping in the game. They've done a lot of that the whole season long. Backs in the game, and Collins in particular, did a good job picking up the blitz individually, so got to give him some credit for that. But I think a lot of it was just Joe finding open receivers under a very favorable circumstances. So you have less people in the secondary. There's less traffic to throw into, more area to throw a receiver open. And throwing a receiver open, for example, is something he did with Wallace on the long pass. There's several different points to which he could have thrown that ball that Wallace could have run to and made the catch ahead of the defensive back who was covering him. You kind of think of it as, in economics, we have an efficient frontier, but there's a whole kind of line of places that the ball could have gone where Wallace would have been the first guy to get to it, and he picked a great spot to throw him open there. Made a number of back shoulder throws on the sideline, which is something I want to see return to the Ravens offense. He still has that cannon arm to get the ball to the sideline before the defensive back can do anything about it. And the back shoulder throw came back, I want to say, about 3 times in this game. So it was a very positive thing.
That's great. That's exciting. What about the pass protection in recent games? At Vengeance on Twitter asks, what's up with, is there a change? Is there a 5-man front, help from the weak side? And do you have any recollection what it was like the last time we played Pittsburgh? Yeah, week 3, 4, whenever that was.
Right. So in week 4, how did their pass protection differ? Well, I don't know that I can say specifically with regard to week 4, but I will say as the season has gone along here, they've done more to try and protect Austin Howard and to an extent Ronnie Stanley as well with chip blocks from eligible receivers leaving the backfield. And that's been very effective with some use of Ricard on that. And with other use of Hurst usually helping Stanley from the inside as well. So a combination of things to help your tackles deal with edge rushers, I think, has really helped. The Steelers can bring it from everywhere. They can certainly bring it from the inside where they have Stephon Tuitt and they have Cam Hayward, and they can bring it from the outside where they have T.J. Watt and Bud Dupree. So they have a lot of weapons, and the Ravens will really be tested in this next game at Pittsburgh.
Right. All right, here's one of those guys who is really watching the playoff lines. And this is Vermont Raven on Twitter. Correct me if I'm wrong. For week 14, the best results for the Ravens are the Chargers to lose to Washington, Miami to lose to New England, Buffalo to lose to Indy, and the Jets lose to Denver. And then Kansas City or Oakland have to get their seventh loss.
Okay, so let's go this one at a time.
All right.
The Jets lose to Denver, absolutely. The Ravens cannot win a tiebreaker with the Jets, even though it's very, very unlikely.
Right.
So they need to have the Jets get one more loss. So the a loss to Denver would be terrific.
Right.
What
the sooner
the
better.
The games?
Chargers and Redskins.
Okay, so Chargers and Redskins is an interesting game. Obviously, the Ravens would love for the Chargers to lose to the Redskins because it's a loss for the Chargers. But if the Chargers beat the Redskins, then the Ravens actually seal the tiebreaker with the Chargers, which is also not a terrible result. So either one of those kind of works. One's a big win if they go in and lose to Washington. One's a half win if they go in and beat Washington.
All right, so that's one to not worry about too much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we've got Miami losing to New England to get the eighth loss.
Okay, sure. I mean, if you want to avoid three-way ties, that's kind of an obvious one. But Miami's not gonna start winning ball games, so I don't really have a fear of that. But yeah, there's no reason for the Ravens not to root for New England to beat Miami. The only one I can see is that if New England takes a loss, it might be good for the point that New England will still be playing hard in Week 17 when they play Buffalo. So that would be a key one.
And that brings us to Buffalo and Indy this weekend. I guess, is Tyrod playing this week? Have you seen?
I have not heard, but I did see something about Nathan Peterson is ready if needed kind of thing.
Yeah, right, just like last time. He showed us all he was ready.
Yeah.
Obviously, like you were saying with New England, it'd be good if Buffalo gets their loss, whether it's this week or at some point we need them to get another loss.
Yeah, need Buffalo to get one more loss. Buffalo can win an oddball tiebreaker at 10-6 with the Ravens. It's going to be much harder for them to win a tiebreaker at 9-7. But Buffalo has a pretty easy schedule the rest of the way, so they're a little bit scary in terms of what they can do. The Ravens are a game ahead; they should be able to deal with it. But yes, they're of course rooting for Buffalo to lose another game.
All right, and then here's a quick one from Edgar Catano.
It's Caetano.
That's what I said. I said Caetano.
Okay.
I think. I'm looking at the pronunciation. He ends it with, quick one, what do you make of how Woodhead's been used and what he brings to the offense since the return? By the way, Josh, it's Caetano. Cheers, guys. So he knows I struggle with names and gave me the pronunciation.
Yeah, everybody needs to give their phonetic pronunciation to Josh. I'll say, by the way, this is not a problem for Josh alone. I used to be on the coach's buzz from time to time, and he would always call me Matuzak. And I don't know how you get that out of the spelling of my name, but he remembered John Matuzak from the 70s, who was a fine lineman anyway. Edgar says, ask the question about Danny Woodhead. And I'll say this, that Danny has not had the kind of impact on the offense that I would have expected. And I think that's probably a good thing because people expected Woodhead to come back and immediately be the guy that is the target of every pass. And, you know, he's going to catch 7 passes a game and he's going to run for 30 yards and catch 80 yards worth of passes and score 2 touchdowns every game. And the offense is going to come back to life because of that. In truth, Collins has remained the feature back. They've had Woodhead out there on third down a fair amount. I think Woodhead has done a pretty good job as a pass blocker. Had 2 beautiful cut blocks in this last game that I noticed. There may have been another. And, you know, it's really something that I'm happy that his contribution is kind of low-key in this regard, that he's not needed for every third down conversion, because the Ravens offense would be that much more sickly if they were relying on him more.
All right. I think you got to this one earlier, but we'll just readdress it. How does Skura and Hurst level play affect the 2018 O-line as far as Lewis and Hurst and Skura? How would that affect them? This comes in from Meteor Reed.
So lots of complication there. You got 5 guys at guard, and you hopefully will have center back. We'll have Jensen back at center. So you really have 5 guys for 2 spots. I think Skura's play this year indicates to me he should at least be a backup in this league. I am a little bit concerned about putting Skura at center and not having the same anchor that they have with Jensen. But I think that Skura is at least a very serviceable backup in this league. He's played certainly well enough for that. And the Ravens have him for three more cheap years. So it'd be really nice to take advantage of that. With Hurst, I think it's just a matter of, can they really work out the contract? I think the team would probably be best served to bring him back at left guard and to try and either have a third, you know, solid guard, or have a an opportunity to move Alex Lewis to right tackle. Either of those is possible. Another possibility is that Marshall Yanda retires. You know, he's coming back off an injury, and you know, we just never know. You never know when the end is coming with an injury, so you've got to be fearful of that.
Sure.
Nico Siragusa might move into the best chance to get the center role if Jensen leaves, so that could weaken the guard position. And, you know, there's just a lot of different potential moving parts in there. It's also one of the things I considered this last year is moving Alex Lewis to center, and I kind of like that idea within the context of him being back. You know, you want a healthy player at center. You want a guy who wants to stay healthy, but
it seems like there's some depth there to work with.
There is. There's a lot of interior line depth.
So, all right, then let's close it out with a defensive question. Crunk Juice, I can handle that name, asks, based on your analysis of C.J. Mosley, why do you think PFF ranks him as a below-average linebacker?
Okay, so we'll handle this one in the show. Not normal, but we like to do defensive and offensive.
Yeah, normally we separate them, but I feel like we're going to have a lot to talk about after Sunday night, so
yeah, I figured we'll squeeze it in. Okay, so Mosley, I did make a comment on the defensive show that I don't think that he's really providing as many splash plays as he needs to. He's had some interceptions. He had a big fumble recovery with a return, but he has not had a bunch of tackles for loss recently. And maybe part of it is that he's hobbling a little bit, but I honestly think he needs to step it up here. And I'm a little concerned about what's going on here because we're going to a point where they're going to have to make a decision on Mosley. They're going to certainly pay him next year to stay for his fifth year. And to do that, they have to pay him a much higher salary to do it. And then they have to decide if they're going to sign him long term, which is also going to be quite expensive. And they have to decide how to time that, whether they preempt the 2018 salary, pay a little bit less on the front end, more on the back end, to keep him for long term immediately. And that also would mean his overall contract will be a little smaller because he's guaranteed more money up front. So I think with CJ, he certainly is a team leader. He's the signal caller. He's out there every snap that he can be. You want this guy to be on the team for the long time, but you are making a big franchise decision on a cornerstone player. And if he's taken a step back or if there's anything that he's lost that might be significant, I would be concerned about investing the entire bankroll in him. And he's going to be expensive. It's going to be probably a $55 million contract for 5 years, maybe even a little bit more than that. And that's a lot of money for one player.
Right. Yeah, hopefully we'll see him improve over the next couple of weeks and grow into the guy that we all want him to be, and finally get one of those. He was a first round pick, right?
So yeah,
it'd
absolutely
be nice to get a first round pick finally pan out as a star.
Right.
All right, Ken, your article is up on Russell Street Report right now for the offense.
It is. So you go to Russell Street Report and look for Film Study. If you want to follow me online, I'm at Film Study Ravens, and we tweet all day long about stuff. There's a lot of good back and forth, and it's not just asking me a question. You ask me a question with an at Film Study Ravens, and all kinds of other people will jump in with their opinion too, which is just great. Gets a good discussion going. I love it.
Yeah.
How about you, Josh?
My show is Section 336. Most recent episode up. We talk about this Steeler-Ravens rivalry and why we like it. We talked about Dan Duquette, and he went on a radio station and made some comments that a lot of people bashed because they said it sounded like he wasn't doing anything and didn't care. So we talked about some of the moves that Dan Duquette made with his career here, and how, when you look at it, Dan Duquette's done a lot of really good stuff with the pocketbook held back.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about that as well. So every Monday, new show in Section 336.
How are the Orioles set up in this coming year for having a good stable of optionable pitchers?
I am not sure yet. they should be okay because they still have a lot of young guys in the bullpen right now. So they've got some guys that they can get that Norfolk shuttle rolling if they'd like to.
Right. Okay. So it's good to have like one to two starters and about four relievers that you can put in that category if you can.
Sure. And the problem is we have no clue who those starters will be this year. And that's really the focus right now. At least it's our focus and hopefully Dan Duquette's focus as well. So, all right, Ken, well, we will talk after Sunday night's Ravens-Steeler Sunday night football game.
Have a good weekend.